Session number 23848, Rail 11.
Mr. Wildgust, Rail 11.
I'm finishing up about censoring letters. The only interesting thing that ever happened was when I was censoring a sergeant's letter, and I suddenly realised the letter was to a married woman I knew, a friend of the family. So I signed my name very clearly on the envelope, and when I saw her again some years later, she said, "You censored one of my letters." I said, "Yes, I did," but that was all she said. But I thought that was quite a coincidence.
What were the your instructions from above in terms of what a soldier could write home and what had to be taken out? I mean, obviously it was destinations and so on, but what else was...
Well, it was really destinations and units and what you did, but some of them used to say we'd had an air raid or we had this down there and we were doing this. I left it in. I didn't think it was necessary because they knew if you were on active service you were likely to come across these things.
What about your own letters home?
You sent them yourself. But I think personally the censorship was a bit too harsh. I don't think it was really necessary to the extent that they did it. But I suppose it gave people a sense of security and, this careless talk costs lives attitude. And it also, I suppose, made, to some extent, made them feel that they were in an important position, that anybody should even want to know what they were doing.
Now, you've talked a little bit earlier about kind of the educational standards of soldiers. Mm. When you were confronted with, at this stage, you know, they were drafted, they weren't your platoons, your platoon yet, but this draft of men. In terms of educational standards, I mean, was it?
Oh, it was pretty low. I mean, at that time, you could leave school at 14, I believe. 16 wasn't compulsory. It is compulsory now, isn't it, 16? But it certainly wasn't compulsory, 14. And, of course, in those days, when, with money being short, they were only too pleased to get their children from school and into work. And although there was a lot of poverty, at least there was employment, and most people did have a job of sorts. But with the foresters coming from Nottingham and Derbyshire, the vast majority, there were a tremendous number of miners who left the pits because they wanted to get out of the mines, and they felt the army was a better better life for them. But many of them were just labourers and errand boys, as I said in that list. There weren't many in jobs which required a very high education. I suppose those men were either picked off by the RAF or the Navy, and being more intelligent, they probably, that's where they went. We've been through all that before, but I mean, why I stuck to the army and went to the army, I don't know. I suppose probably in a way I'd have done better if I'd gone to another arm, but
now,
that was it.
Just on the subject of censorship, you were forced to read these letters. Was there any point, was there any memories of possibly like reading a letter and thinking, well, maybe I should kind of intervene here and have a word with this soldier, you know, problems at home?
Well, I think there were times when I gave them back and said you ought to cross that out or do that, but it was very rare, because as I say, most of them weren't really literate enough to write a letter. I mean, they'd get these field postcards where you could cross off I am well, or I am ill, or I am wounded, or I have received a letter from you, rather like the prisoner of war thing. And that's all they did. They just struck out what they didn't want to say and left what was what they needed to say. One chappy always used to cross out everything apart from I am okay and leave it at that. Sent one every day, you know. But,
so the ship arrived at Algiers. Mm-hmm. Was that a surprise? Or not? I suppose not. After
No, well, it was and it wasn't. I mean, again, I was more taken with the aspect of the harbour from the ship, which was very romantic. And we had to sort of got the idea that on the ship that we were going to North Africa. But there again, to give you an example of education, one of the officers who was supposed to be superior to me said, where's Africa? So I said, well, you know, there's a map. And I tried to explain what it was like. Well, he said, I'm very bad at geography. And I thought, crack, here's a bloke in charge of me. He doesn't even know where Africa is, you see. But he generally didn't. But when we explained where it was, he said, oh, you mean that there's a country with a big lump on it? I said, yeah, that's Africa. Oh, he said, oh, it's the top. So that was it. But we gathered then we were going to Africa. So, of course, when we went through the Straits of Gibraltar, we knew it. So it was a foregone conclusion.
What did you understand about the military situation in Tunisia at this
point? Well, by the time we about got there, they said, the news came round that Montgomery was in Tunisia, and everybody sort of took the view, oh, that's it, we're not even going to get there before it's over. And to some extent, I think there was a sort of sense of relief that it wasn't going to be necessary for us to do anything. But that was short-lived. I mean, when we landed and sort of got a better idea of the news, they realised that they were stuck at the Marath line, and although they've got their toe into Tunisia, that's as much as they had done. And by that, I don't know whether we never really got much news of what was going on in the front that we were going to. Except that there was fighting still going on, but there was nothing ever definite. Nothing definite was said about it.
So the ship arrived in Algiers. You knew that Tunisia was the destination.
I remember when I was in, before I went abroad, I was asked to be information officer, I think, and they expected me to write a report of the political situation at the time, which was put on a notice board. And I remember Stalingrad was happening about the same time, and the Western Desert was going, and I remember making political, at least tactical remarks about the situation at the time. But when we got to Africa, it was sort of a shutdown on all news. We never knew really what was happening, or even in fact where we were going, or the names of places we were going. It was all very much in the future.
Was there any orientation talks or anything aboard the ship about how to deal with the local population or the French colonial situation or anything? Was there?
No, the only thing that I remember ever being said was that don't wear sunglasses unless you've got to, because once you wear them, you'll have to keep on wearing them. And funny enough, I've never worn sunglasses since, even now. People say, why? I said, well, I always remember, and that was it. No, there wasn't. There was no talk about the natives or the fact that, I mean, I knew it was French, or at least a French colony, and I was... It didn't take me long. In fact, within a week, I said they'll never keep this country, because the way the French treated their colonial colonies was absolutely disgusting. I mean, they used to criticise us of the British Empire, but the French, they had no thought for the natives or the Arabs at all.
Could you just describe how that impression? How you got that?
Well, the fact that the French in Algiers lived in luxury, and the Arabs were just treated as third-rate characters. I mean, they were virtually slaves. It did affect me, because I wasn't politically minded, but I said there and then, I said the French will never keep this after the war, because they kept all the fertile land for themselves. And whereas they lived in reasonable houses and farms, the Arabs in those days were living in mud huts and, you know, straw and filth, generally speaking. And how they ever got the French inhabitants to fight for them, God only knows. I'm not. I'd have thought there'd been a revolution years before. And of course, there were all these. In Algiers, the headquarters of the Foreign Legion were there, nearby. I've got the name of the place now. And we came across the Foreign Legion quite a lot. A lot of Spaniards from the Spanish Civil War Republican side who had left Spain and joined up. And I wish I could remember the name of the barracks now. But we were about 12 miles from Algiers, in the Bay of Algiers, a place called Maison Carré.
Oh, could you just describe how you got off the troop ship? How did you get to that?
We went there by lorries, and we disembarked. We didn't really have to do anything about stores or anything. We were just sort of lined up or told to get your men in order, and we got into 5 tonnes, 15 tonnes, whatever, 5 tonnes, and were driven. And it was on a map, Algiers in the middle of the Bay of Algiers, and we were about 12 miles to the west. And the camp was tented. There were some permanent buildings, but mainly tents, in a very sandy olive, I think they were olive trees, olive eucalyptus trees. And it was quite a pleasant position, actually. The sea was very near. And everybody sort of got bedded down, and the mess was very civilised. It was quite a good building where they got for the mess. I don't know what it had been beforehand, but the first morning I went down for breakfast, in walked a friend of mine who'd been on the course at Bransforth Castle with me. And
who was that?
A fellow called Stevenson, Dick Stevenson. He was in the Hampshire Regiment. And he spoke French pretty fluently. And because of that, and because he became one of my best friends, or I became one of his best friends after the war, he spoke French very fluently, and so we stuck together, and he made life very easy for us in Algiers. Mm. He'd been there about a week or so before me, and already got contacts with some of the locals. But we had quite a reasonable time. I mean, it was.
So how long were you at Maison Carré?
About, it seemed a long while, but it was about 3 weeks, I suppose. Mm.
And what was your daily routine there with your draft of soldiers?
Well, you went through the same old thing, weapon training and rifle drills up to a point. Route marches. We used to do fairly strenuous, at least I made my men do rather strenuous ones of the old scout pace, you know, 50 marching and 50 running, doubling, and one or two of them cursed me for that. But we were very proud of the fact that overtaking the Welsh Guards on a route march and leaving them miles behind.
Could you just describe how that happened?
Well, funny enough, the guards, when they are on a route march, they don't march in time. They sort of, well, they tend to slouch it on. They just go at their own pace, and they look. In fact, they hardly look like soldiers. And so I made it my job to catch them up and overtake them. And but at the end, one or two men were a bit annoyed with me and said it was. In fact, they complained bitterly. They said, "This is too much." I said, "Well, I've done it, so you can now do it as well." But again, they were okay. And
did you use marching songs at all? Were they popular?
The old First World War. We never got beyond that. Lily Marlene hadn't become popular by that time. There were one or two. I don't know, I can't remember, I've got sixpence, that sort of thing, but they sort of stuck to the First World War one. They had a fair, I think they had a fairly easy time. We didn't sort of, at least I didn't, we didn't push them. I can never remember, funnily enough, having a superior officer when I was there. I sort of did my own thing, and nobody said yay or nay. We did duty officer, and at one time I was duty officer and had two parachute officers under open arrest, and immediately invited them to come into the mess with me, and they'd been put under open arrest because they'd decided to change a pig that their quartermaster was breeding, and it was a very big one. They decided to pinch this big pig and replace it with a little Arab pig, which was about a foot long. And they dressed up as Arabs, blacked the faces, and got into this pigsty. Much to their surprise, to catch a pig was harder than they thought, and they chased this round the pigsty for quite a long while before they got hold of it. And on the way out, they were arrested or stopped by military policemen. And they continued to pretend they were Arabs. And they were, they were taken into the commanding officer's office. And they eventually, of course, had to disrobe. And they found that they got two British officers who were there. They were quite a couple. But I don't know what happened to them eventually. I mean,
can you remember their names?
One was named Stevenson. And I can't remember. Yes, it was Stevenson. Or was it Richard? I remember I saw his name mentioned. Whether it was the same man, I don't know. When the paratroopers came out of Arnhem and crossed the Rhine, but they were the first parachute brigade, and of course they won some of the first troops to land in North Africa. Why they were at base, I don't know whether they were replacements or not. But I remember they said that when we get out of here, we'll take you, and if you want to do a parachute jump, we'll tell you what to do. And we said, oh, yes, we'll do it, like idiots. Luckily, we never did, but we should probably have been court-martialed ourselves if we tried it. But in those days, you sort of did things without thinking. And the only other thing of great interest is the fact that when the Americans and the British landed in North Africa, they drank in 3 months about 2 years' supply of wine. So they had to ration it, and they only opened the bars from, I think it was 5 PM until 7 PM. So, of course, in that 2 hours, rather like the Australians when they had this sort of limited time, everybody drank as much as they could. And the officers were only officers were allowed in the Aletti Hotel, which was the main one in Algiers. And we used to drink white wine and lemonade, which they call champagne. And, wine, naturally more than beer. And we used to put it away in large quantities. Steve and I went to the paymaster and got ourselves 10 shillings one night, which was all we had. And I think they'd only allow you to have 10 shillings at a time. I don't know. It was something daft anyway. And we wandered off into Algiers. And into the bar came an American private parachutist. Now, we knew that American parachutists and privates earned a darn sight more money than we did. So we invited him to join us at our table. And, of course, he had what they had. If you're lucky, you got a fried egg full stop or an artichoke. That was about as much food as you did get. And we didn't expect him to pay. In fact, I think we paid our whack. But he pulled out a wad of notes out of his back pocket like we had never seen before in our lives. So, but being officers and gentlemen, we decided we ought to pay our whack. And his name was Marshall Mitchell from Northport, Virginia. And I only knew that man from 7 o'clock at night until 10, when we three of us celebrated our friendship by peeing on Algiers post office together, and he went his way and we went ours. And after the war I wrote to that address, and I had a letter back from his sister to say he'd been killed in action in Italy. And it's funny, I think that was the funny thing about the wartime. You met somebody, for, as we did, for 3 hours, and it remained so vivid for no apparent reason. I mean, you can meet other people and live with them for a month and you can't remember a damn thing about them. But this particular man I always remember. And I wrote and obviously told her what had happened to me, but I didn't have a reply after that. But
was he the first American serviceman that you'd become friends with?
Yes, I mean, there were some in Algiers. The strange thing was that when the time came to move up to the line, we were on a train in the sidings in Algiers station, and a train pulled in from Iran full of Americans. And they didn't know that there were any British in North Africa at all. And the two trains pulled up alongside each other, and a lot of swapping and pinching of helmets and equipment went on between the two. And these Americans, of course, the Americans had all got tin hats on. And we said that they put them on when they left America and never took them off until they had to. And they said, gee, limeys, and all that sort of rubbish. And never knew you guys were over here. But of course, the British were from Algiers to the front, and the Americans were from Iran to Casablanca. And there were very few in the forward areas at that time. They moved up later on, and of course, they got kicked out of Kasserine and never really played much of a part in the war after that. But they had anti-aircraft units along the front in places like Constantine and Bone and God knows what. But we were surprised that they were so ignorant of what was going on in the war. But then of course the Americans there was one time when Steve and I were very drunk and we were coming back from Algiers, and they had smoke screens which they lit that bellowed smoke all over the Algiers Bay to mask it from bombing. And in the bay there was a merchant ship that had been sunk, and the Americans had put an anti-aircraft battery on the wreck. And to give an idea of what they were like, a walrus, an aircraft, one or two flying around there, and because they'd never seen it before, they shot it down. But they didn't seem to worry them that it was a friendly and allied plane. But they were very gullible, and I say, when we were staggering back to camp one night, this tanker rolled up with an American in it. Well, forgetting that the driver was on the other side, we opened the door and he nearly fell out, thinking it was the passenger side, and we asked for a lift, and he asked us where we were going, and we told him, and when we got there, he didn't drop us off. He drove us right into the camp and said, King George provides the petrol, Uncle Sam provides the wagon, and he says, I'll see you to your unit, you know. And we thought, that's jolly decent of him. They're very easy to get on with, but not very well disciplined, we didn't think, you know.
What do you think they thought of you, the British?
Oh, they thought we were rather cute, I think. But, because all Americans, all sort of, particularly where American women love to hear the English speak, because they never heard anything quite like it, you know.
What did you, other veterans have talked about, you know, you've mentioned earlier the money, higher pay. What about the uniforms and the general standard of turnout and so on? It's,
well, the Americans.
Yeah.
Well, they're all allowed to wear ties, and their uniforms were far better quality. I mean, they were easier to wear, I suppose. That didn't sort of, we never thought about it, really. We didn't feel envious of them particularly. what they were good at, I mean, what amazed us was the amount of equipment that was there. The trucks and lorries and transport was phenomenal. We thought, how the hell did they get all this over here? And I was talking to a fellow in the RASC who was a driver. He was commissioned, and his truck broke down. And he took it to the British workshops, and they couldn't do it. It was rather like, they couldn't possibly do it. And he had to, if he did anything, he had to sign it in triplicate and the rest of it. So he thought, oh, bugger this. He took it to an American workshop, and he said, can he repair this? And they said, where are you going? And they said, right, well, they gave him a new truck. They said, leave your truck here, do what you've got to do, which was drive up to Tunisia and do what he had to do, then come back. And when he came back, his truck was waiting for him, and he didn't have to sign for anything, and he just took the one he'd borrowed, they took it back, and they said, okay, no. And he said he couldn't believe it with all the red tape there was in the British Army, yet the Americans, for some reason, didn't seem to have any thought of that sort of thing. I mean, the stuff was there to be used, and whoever needed to use it, used it. But,
what about the French, you know, you mentioned the Foreign Legion. Did you have any contact with French troops back in Algeria?
Yes, in the front line. The only thing I remember about the French troops, they had telephone headquarters for a short time in Abitano headquarters, and all they did was sit and say, hello, 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 hello. They never seemed to say anything else. We found a wood full of equipment that they'd thrown away, helmets and stuff, when there'd been a small German advance. They weren't particularly cooperative. The Arabs certainly weren't. I mean, they were on the side of the side which happened to be doing well at the time. They'd sell eggs to either side, and if you were winning, they were on your side, but if you were losing, they weren't. You know, they were a bit volatile, I think is the word. And we didn't come across many of the true French at all. The ones we came across were generally Arab, French Arab. I mean, they all spoke French, but there were mixtures between Moroccan Arabs and Algerians. We did come across a couple of girls in the equivalent of Woolworths, Monopoly, and took them to a dance where they hadn't seen white bread for. In fact, they spent the time eating because they'd never seen such food. And that was the end of that episode.
That dance was in a military...
And it was, funny enough, it was a French band, and of course... the French dance music is not of our type. They don't seem to have any rhythm. I don't know what it is about the French, but they were all right. But we didn't really come in contact with them.
So on your nights out in Algiers, you'd be really you'd be with other servicemen and...
Yeah. Well, we used to go to this La Petite Taverne, which he'd come across, and one night there was an air raid, and everybody... left this place. People were rushing downstairs. It was a boarding house. And the last person out was the owner, the woman, who gave us the key to look after the property. So we found ourselves in an empty sort of pension in charge of it. And we, like true Britons, we sat there all the time through the air raid and then gave them the key back when it came back. They